Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It'll be a good one today because there's a lot of bad news. And also, Gareth Porter has finally written about the Syria chemical weapons attack of last August. And I know it's kind of old news, but it's still very important. And of course, there'll be plenty of follow-up questions to ask about the recent chlorine attacks. Alleged chlorine attacks? I don't know. See what he has to say about that. He's in truthout.org. You can find in the top headlines today at antiwar.com. New data raised further doubt on official view of August 21 gas attack in Syria. So please take a look at that, and he'll be on the show here in just a little while. Oh, and speaking of which, I need to write up a little old blog entry here. You know, so that the people know that there's a show. So they can listen to it if they want. Yeah, well. I'm at scotthorton.org. That's my website. scotthorton.org/listen. To listen to the website. To listen to the show at the website. See, I can't do two and three things at once, man. I'm terrible. Yeah. Anyway, Gareth on the show. Also, lots and lots and lots of bad news. And your phone calls. Because, hey, why not do phone calls? You know what? I meant to set up the phone at the top of the hour. Well, I'll get to it at the quarter. Maybe we'll take a couple calls. Then we'll get to Gareth Porter. Plus, I got a ton of news from here, there, and all over the place. Today, Gareth Porter. It's another day on the Scott Horton Show, and Gareth Porter's going to be here. That's how we do it around here. Gareth's my favorite, man. So, that's why it's like this. That's who I want to hear from. There you go. And you know what it really is? And here's what talk radio has always been to me, has always meant to me. That you get to find out, and I get to find out, what's good for reading. That was how I came to love talk radio in the first place. I'll never forget, man. I know right where I was. I was on I-35 headed north, right around Breaker Lane. And at this time, it was like 96, 97. So Carl Wigglesworth, he had a non-compete down there in San Antonio. And he was going from one to the other. So he was in Austin for a year or two. And I just remember this little old lady called and said, "Well, Carl, I'm reading Compromised. Clinton, Bush, and the CIA." Now, this is probably like 95 or 96 or something. "Clinton, Bush, and the CIA. And I'll tell you what, these presidents running against each other, these guys, and they're all selling cocaine to the kids, and boy, it's something else." And I thought, wow, you know what? Dan Rather doesn't ever talk about that book. And, you know, neither does neither do any of the local TV news people either. But where, in an age right at the dawn of the internet anyway, where can people go to find out what's good to read? What they need to know that they ain't being told? Talk radio. It's perfect. Anybody can call and recommend a book. Well, so that's what I'm doing. I've gone from caller to host, and all I do is sit up here all day recommending reading. You noticed. Anyway, Gareth Porter, he's the best, man. So I will hit publish right here. Then that's going to, I hope, automatically go out as a tweet to the masses and masses of Twitter followers at Scott Horton Show. Follow me on Twitter, by all means. Retweet me. Yeah, so there you go. APSRadioNews.com. DailyPaulRadio.com, AnomalyRadio.com, ScottHorton.org/listen, ScottHorton.org/chat, where you can join up the chat room. In fact, there are two or three new people in the chat room yesterday, one of whom I believe, was also a first-time caller on the show. So that was cool. So I like doing calls, and I like, you know, hanging out with you guys in the chat room. So join up if you want, scotthorton.org/chat. All right, so good. I got to remember, too, I don't think this is in Garrett's article, and I actually haven't had a chance. I got to try to, one of these commercial breaks, I got to read the last three or four paragraphs of this thing. But I want to ask him about the Israeli intercepts about the chemical weapons attack. Was that already debunked in a separate place? I forget. Anyway, Gareth Porter, he's finally written about the sarin attack last August, and we're going to find out what he says. Oh, and I wanted to ask about the earlier attacks, too, as well as the later, because remember last spring, there were a couple of attacks, and the Israelis got out ahead of the narrative and tried to start blaming it on Assad, and Kerry told them to cool it. Remember 1 year ago? And he said, well, you know, we haven't seen the evidence of that, and we ain't so sure, and hey, cool it, guys. I think all he meant was wait a little bit. We're not ready to quite have that, you know, cooked up and ready to go yet. Anyway, we'll see what happens. I will remember to ask Garrett, because I'm writing it down. All right. Now, man, okay, I got so much news. Shut up, Horton, and tell them the news. Wall Street Journal, NBC poll. Americans want less interventionist foreign policy. Less interventionist foreign policy. Oh, lordy, lordy, hallelujah, and whatever exclamations people make when they're happy. I don't really have emotions, but for those of you people get happy, those things that you say when you're happy, yeah, man, for that. Look at this. Americans want to pull back from the world stage. The fact that these people call it a stage just goes to show how self-important they all are and why it is the way it is. Because it makes them feel important. It helps get them attention for implementing these policies, for agreeing with the people who have a little bit more power than them, that, yeah, what you're doing is a good idea. The world stage. That's how America got involved in World War I. Woodrow Wilson wanted to be an actor on the world stage. He ruined everything for everyone, and because of his intervention, Soviet communism and German Nazism came into existence. And then, therefore, World War II and the whole Cold War and all those proxy wars and all that could be traced back to Wilson's great blunder, as Jim Powell puts it. But anyway, the world stage. Americans are over it, especially right in the middle of all this scaremongering about Russia and Ukraine and, oh, Russian aggression, and they're going to take the Ukraine. And the American people's response is tough. They support sanctions, according to one poll, but I think that's because, of course, sanctions are always pushed as an alternative to worse action. So they're saying, yeah, go ahead and sanction them, but sure as hell don't do anything about it. Not really. Thank goodness. Isn't it nice to know that that's people's, you know, prevalent attitude? That's the consensus now. I don't know how rock solid it is, depending on what crisis crops up. But it's getting harder and harder all the time to pretend that we're the sleeping giant, with, you know, beset by enemies for no reason other than our glorious virtue. So I guess we'll see. And now it looks here like the Democrats have finally really given in when John Kerry says that the U.S. is prepared to defend every single piece of NATO territory. What he means is, we ain't doing a damn thing about Ukraine. And good. And you know what? I sure hope that the Russians don't invade eastern Ukraine. You know, my wife's family is from there. And at least, I don't know about them. I haven't really talked with them about it. But my wife is very concerned that the Russians, if they take the east, they're going to go all the way to Odessa, where she's from. And you know, there are a lot of Ukrainians who have a lot of reason to mistrust and resent the Russians, you know, with the famine of the 30s and all that, all the oppression of Soviet communism and the oppression of their language and culture under communism and all that kind of thing. So there's a lot, you know, for people there to resent. And I sure hope for their sake that the Russians don't intervene. But that's only my private opinion. That sure as hell is not a policy. I mean, none of this is a policy for America to be involved in. My policy is that America should have no Ukraine policy at all. Other than we all have personal opinions that, sorry to hear, to whatever degree, you do not have self-determination as free individual human beings. Same as everybody else in the world. But, and you know what? Maybe in the scheme of world empires, it's really important who controls the Crimean Peninsula there. But I don't think America should be a world empire. And I think if that's what Russia wants to do, what they're ultimately doing, as we've seen before, is they're biting off more than they can chew. That's the same thing with all empires. You would think, in fact, I do think that Putin probably, just by judging from his own country and now our recent examples, that empire is suicide. You're much better off just forging an agreement than pushing across borders. But I guess we'll see. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Wait, was I done sniffling before I hit the button or not? Yeah, sometimes the hemispheres of my brain don't coordinate things too well. I don't know. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, sorry about the glitchy audio there on the ads and the... I guess it's just the ads, not so much the news. Not sure why that's happening. We're going to get it ironed out. I hope it's not too bad in your ear holes, especially those of you with headphones on and stuff. I hope it's not too digital glitchy, dig a hole in your eardrum or anything. It's not too bad, right? It was worse, I think. Anyway, it's all right. It's just some buggy software, but we're going to debug it. It'll be all right. So bear with us. Okay, good. Hey, by the way, thanks to everybody who sent me emails and tweets and everything with your condolences about Man the Cat. You know, I don't really know actually what's going on with this, but the wife says that the neighbor lady says that they're going to demolish the entire house. The health department is. Which makes me think I should get myself and my wife the hell out of here because... how toxic is it in there? For those of you who didn't hear the show yesterday, apparently the gossip from the cops was that they traced missing dogs or a missing dog or something somehow to my next door neighbor. He's now gone. They went in his house, and it's the worst case of hoarding ever, because he apparently hosed it all down, and it's all one big giant rotten pile of they don't even know what. But then, so the assumption is, if somehow my neighbor was responsible for lost animals, then he's responsible for my lost animal, right? And the wife reminded me that, you know, he did have dogs, and then all of a sudden we never heard them barking ever again. So I don't really know, man, what's going on with that, but anyway, he must have murdered my cat, I guess. Federal Express. We employ cat murderers. That'll be my new commercial for them. Nah, it's not their fault, but the guy worked for them. Or at least he left the house in a Federal Express shirt all the time. I don't know. Anyway, so I don't know what's going to happen, but I mean, they say, the neighbor lady said they're going to bulldoze the house. The whole damn house. And I'm thinking, man, if this guy is killing animals, you might, like, search the house for humans first. I don't know how bad of a psycho the dude really was, man. Maybe real bad, right? If he murdered man the cat, then he's about as bad as a Democrat or a Republican. You know what I mean? That's about the lowest kind of human being you could possibly be. Oh, man, the cat. But anyway, I don't know, man. Crazy-ass world. I guess that's why I'm not too, like, shocked about it. Is it like, man, I cover my own government, my own supposed security force that goes around murdering innocent men, women, and children every day. So, you know, of course my next-door neighbor's a pet-murdering psychopath, right? Why wouldn't he be? Why the hell should I have any better, you know, luck than that? It's a great little house for the price if it didn't come with a psychopath cat murderer next door. Huh. Fuck, anyway. Alright, so, yeah, ISIS. Barack Obama's guys in Syria right now. Where the hell is that article? Where's my Sirius section? Oh, you know what? I'm going to save that for the Gareth interview because it's basically part of it. That'll be the introduction. What a war over there, man. I remember when I was a little kid. Lebanon, Lebanon, Lebanon. Beirut, Beirut, Beirut. And I never knew what that was or cared or whatever. It seemed far away and pretty bad. And I sort of had the idea it was the Eastern Mediterranean region over there or something. But I was just a little kid. I'm talking 1980s, you know? Beirut, Beirut, Beirut. I don't even remember when they stopped killing each other over there, but it finally just wore out, you know, I guess at the end of the 1980s. I mean, I know that now, but I didn't note it at the time. It didn't seem like a big deal. It just sort of faded out. But then again, I was just a little kid. But yeah, you know, Eric Margolis and Patrick Coburn both said back 3 years ago that, oh man, what's breaking out right now in Syria could well be one of these 15-year massacres. Pardon me. Like the Lebanese Civil War was. And, well, it sure looks like it. Anyway, moving on here. Didn't I have two Egypt stories? No. Well, is it Carl? Patrick Leahy of the Senate. I thought he was the Judiciary Committee. Well, the Foreign Aid Committee. He's going to try to delay foreign aid to the Egyptian dictatorship. I'm not sure who told him to do that. It could be that that the new military dictator. Oh no, I mean he's standing for election, sorta, kinda, not really. Field Marshal Sisi. You know, I don't know. It could be that he has made alliances with others, that he's working against American interests. Or it could be that this is all just for show, as they pretend to, you know, have differences with this guy. And, anyway. He's supposedly standing for election soon. I guess we'll see what happens. Part of, and of course, this has got to be the case, right? Part of Egyptian politics is all sides accuse all their opponents of being the sock puppets of the Americans and the CIA. And it's true that back in history, at least, America did support the Muslim Brotherhood. The British first, and then handed them off to the Americans. And it's also true that Mubarak was their loyal sock puppet military dictator for 30 years. But now Sisi has overthrown the Muslim Brotherhood and claimed that the Muslim Brotherhood being elected and taking power in 2011 and 12, being elected in the parliament and the presidency, that that was all a CIA plot. And this is what establishes their legitimacy, is that they're declaring independence from America. And as Adam Morrow has explained on the show over and over again, they have a total monopoly on especially television media there, I guess all media in Egypt, and that's the only line. That is the absolute consensus on TV, is, you know, demonizing the Muslim Brotherhood, which I'm not saying they're the greatest or anything, but I'm just saying it's the politics of everyone trying to distance themselves from the great Satan here and pretend that they don't work for us. And I'm sure it's probably true that during that whole revolution, the CIA probably, of course, they had contacts with Mubarak and probably had some contacts with the Muslim Brotherhood and the April 5th movement and whoever else, doing the best they could, as always, to try to contain the catastrophe, the blowback from their policy, to exploit it if they can. And, I mean, it's pretty obvious, right? Unless something miraculous happens, what'll happen is Sisi will be elected, and then he'll be the new Mubarak, and we'll just go on just like before. Just like Sadat before Mubarak. Mubarak. And, you know, on this show, I always call him General Mubarak, because I never accepted the pretext that he was some kind of civilian elected president. Why should anyone? That's stupid. It'll be the same scam with this Sisi guy. He'll still be Field Marshal Sisi to me. Field Marshal. What the hell kind of rank is that? It sounds like a George Carlin making fun of somebody, right? And especially the guy's name is Sisi, which, nothing homophobic there. It's just, it's not much of a tough guy name for a military dictator. I think even homosexuals would agree, right? So, anyway. I just thought that was funny. Pretend civilian military dictator. See if we can get another 30 years out of them. All right. And then, yeah, we're skipping this year for now. Oh, the botched death penalty thing. Didn't I just say on the radio yesterday that, was a couple days ago, I guess. This is why Ron Paul's against the death penalty. You just can't trust him. What they do, they murdered a guy to death for 40 minutes yesterday in Oklahoma. You just can't trust him. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, someone join up the chat room and help out John. He's having troubles here in the show. I can't really help him from here because I got to host a show. So anyway, scotthorton.org/chat. If anybody wants to sign in, hang out, give John advice about what to right click or however the hell you hear this thing, I don't know. All right. Gareth Porter's coming up on the show. Right now, if you like, we can do phone calls. You don't have to talk about the cat and everything. We'll pay attention to the news here, okay? I shouldn't even brought this up on the radio show, man. I'm sorry. Anyway, I guess I have some longtime fans of the show who are sort of longtime fans of Man the Cat, at least vicariously, too, so. But then again, that's even more reason to not bring it up, man. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm sorry. We don't talk about that shit, but let's just, let's talk about the wars and all that. And Gareth Porter's coming up at the top of the hour. We could talk about Afghanistan. And I got a ton of news here. I don't need your damn calls. But we got Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, of course, Libya, Syria, Iran, obviously Ukraine, NATO, Guantanamo, police state issues, and NSA spying and the Supreme Court. I got an email out to Yochai Benkler. I want to talk with him about the Supreme Court's going to rule on them, the cops searching your cell phone. And, you know, on and on and on. I got a million things. I want to hear what you guys think about whatever. You want to talk about Rand Paul and what he means for the future of the libertarian movement and whatever? You can talk about that, too. It's an important, it's an almost inescapably important topic. I mean, he's an extremely important political figure in America, and he draws a lot of opinions, pro and con, from all around. And, you know, even if you're just completely dispassionate about it, it's kind of an interesting thing if you're into, you know, political anthropology to see how this plays out, you know, regardless of your opinion. That's what I think. So I'm happy to hear people talking about that. So anybody wants to call in, number is 512-271-4836. And we gave up the 800 number because, you know, money. Although, I should probably get that taken care of. Anyway, for now, it's 512, and it's free on your cell phone, so same damn thing. 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836. Oh, and I wanted to mention this because I skipped this earlier accidentally when I was talking about the poll. I went straight from the non-intervention poll to the situation in Ukraine there, but one of the things I wanted to work in there was about this. It was just a tweet. I didn't even click the damn headline, and it's lost to the world, and I'm not going to go chasing it or anything. But the headline was from Slate.com, you know, the Democrats. And anyway, the headline was something along the lines of, "We," meaning Americans, speaking for all Americans, "have been acting as though we're living in peacetime. But actually, America is still at war." And the thing of it is I know that. And I really resent that, and it really sucks. And I think all the people dying at the hands of the U.S. government, if they had any idea that, yeah, you know, the Americans think it's peacetime right now, they're not even paying the slightest bit of attention to you getting bombed to death right now, that it would be the worst insult to injury they could possibly imagine. You know, it's absolutely crazy. But I guess I'm kind of in denial about it, too, or I have been. I like denying it. But that headline just, man, that made me mad. You know, I remember in the 1990s, the sanctions against Iraq, for anybody who cared, the no-fly zone bombings and the sanctions, that was war. And they killed hundreds of thousands of people. You want to debate the numbers? Fine. They're within, the margin of error is within hundreds of thousands of people died. The UN said it was 500,000 children that died. And of course, I do have the soundbite here if you want it. Madeleine Albright said it was worth. You know what? There's a chance that someone listening today right now has not heard this before, so I guess I better find my Madeleine Albright quote. Where are you, Albright? Why won't this damn thing play anymore? I have no idea why it won't play anymore. All right, well, anyway, I guess I don't care. Madeleine Albright said it was worth it. "We think the price is worth it." And for what? They weren't even really trying to drive Saddam out of power. They didn't even believe their own lie that if they starved the Iraqi people enough that then they would get sick of Saddam and overthrow him. They didn't believe that. They just said the sanctions regime stays until Saddam falls. And Madeleine Albright announced the policy herself in 1997. And so they just kept on the blockade and the bombing that whole time. And there was the oil for food program. But even where it helped, it was hardly enough to even begin to rebuild what had been destroyed and kept destroyed. And of course, in the Republicans in the first Gulf War have bombed all the waterworks and all of the sewage and all of the electricity and all of the civilian infrastructure of the country. And so it was a massacre. And you know what? But when you think of the 1990s, like Homer Simpson, right? Yeah, it was the era of Jerry Seinfeld and Crystal Pepsi and whatever crappy grunge music you people were listening to. And yet, no, that was the era of genocide. You wondered why they crashed their buildings, your planes, into your buildings. It was revenge from that. From that being carried out against Iraqis from bases in the Arabian Peninsula, to be specific. Not that it was Iraqis that did it, but it was partly avenging their deaths by fellow Arabs. And anyway, it was always a frustration to me, even as a teenager and as a young 20-something and whatever, that it could possibly be that the 90s were considered peacetime, when Bill Clinton had military operations spreading out all over the world, all of this expanding NATO and interventions here and there, and they were mostly relatively small. Nothing like the Bush Jr. years, but still. I mean, that was pretty bad. But to think that the Obama years are considered by Americans en masse, is that really true? Maybe that could be a question for callers. Oh, there's a caller on the line. Hang on one second. Maybe this could be a topic for you guys. Is it really true that it feels like peacetime out there? That really the drone wars or the support for the al-Nusra rebels in Syria, etc., that all of that is so marginalized in the coverage that it doesn't even really reflect the era, that it's just background noise like the 1990s, where it really could pass as peacetime to you, to your family, to people in your neighborhood? Because, you know, obviously I'm up to my eyeballs in this stuff. I'm not a very good judge of whether that's really true when it comes to that kind of thing. And maybe not, maybe you aren't either, but I don't know. Anyway, I'll ask you. And starting with you, hey, I'm Scott. You're on the show. Is it peacetime?
Hey, Scott, it's Fitz. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing? And thanks for joining us. And is it peacetime where you live in America, do you think?
Well, to me it isn't, but I don't know. I'm in my misguided youth. I made a mistake of joining the Army. You know, I've been out for years, but you know, so it's still on my mind. But to my friends, I was kind of as an experiment the other day. I kind of emailed with a couple of friends that are in government that made that mistake. And, you know, we talk about the issues at hand. They completely disagree and don't agree with me. But I just on the topic I brought up with a larger group of friends, just like mostly friends from high school who have, you know, regular jobs, and all of them, yeah, it's as if, you know, complete peacetime. They have no idea about any of this. And I even, what they really couldn't believe is, you know, just like you were saying, that saying, oh, don't you realize all during the Clinton administration, we were on average bombing, you know, doing a bombing campaign in Iraq every 2 days. You know, I was from you put me on a Joy Gordon's book through your show, and so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're like, oh, what? No, I couldn't believe it. Because, you know, so a couple of my friends, their big Clinton nieces, were like, just couldn't believe it. Like, oh, no, of course not. That can't be true. So it's amazing how much people, like, people who are reasonably intelligent people, you know, have good jobs, like even professional class people, like one of my old high school friends who's, well, it seems like all of them have jobs that you'd absolutely hate. And I'm very discouraged by, like, one of them is a government lawyer, you know, a prosecutor. He was telling me, you know, he and also another friend of mine, who really should know better because he worked at the State Department, were saying, like, oh, yes, how can you like that? And he was arrested. Like,
all right, wait, I'm sorry. I'll interrupt you for just a second, only because your phone is really bad on us. So while you're seeing if you can get your phone straight, let me ask you or give you a chance if you want to. I'm not sure if that's what you called about or not, so you can say what else you called about, too. I just kind of put that question on you at the last second there.
Oh, no problem. No, actually, and it was what I was thinking, so that actually was what I called about. Sorry about that. I'm off Bluetooth now. I hope that sounds better.
Oh, yeah, you sound way better. Go ahead.
So,
yeah, please, everybody, no headphones or speakerphone or anything extra. It always makes it sound worse. But
yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
So, yeah, a friend of mine who should know better. He's in, you know, worked for the State Department, and another friend of mine is, you know, a prosecutor, everything, a lawyer. And I mean, people who should know better were saying, oh, you know, he fled to Russia. He took all his computers, and, they, you know, when he went through China and Russia, they got all his info off that. I mean, you know, you're an idiot if you don't think he's completely betraying America. And I'm like, if you actually read, you'll see that he didn't take any computers with any information beyond anywhere except when he passed that off to Greenwald and Poitras in Hong Kong. I mean, he took computers with him, but they didn't have anything at all about, you know, NSA info on there. You know, they don't have any. I mean, you can just, it was all news to these people, and they still probably don't believe me.
Right.
So it's just, I mean, people just seem to buy the government line, hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, man, it's just too bad. I mean, I don't know. Well, we'll just keep plugging along here, and you know what? I don't know. I don't imagine I can change it, but at least I can try to be a place where people can come if they want to have access to truth, you know, if they're looking. But
well, actually,
thanks for your call, man. We
got to
take this break. It's a hard break, but
no
appreciate
problem.
It. All right, y'all. Anybody else wants to call? It's 512-271-4836.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. The number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Gareth Porter's coming up. He's going to say real smart stuff, I bet. So, yeah, as far as phone calls, the question of the day is whatever you want. But also, the question of the day is about this Slate headline that I saw. I didn't read it. Now, people think it's peacetime right now. You know, Obama gave this statement the other day. He was being he was on his tour trying to round up all of our as many Pacific allies as possible for the Cold War against China for no reason that we don't need at all. That's horrible. And he was going around, and somebody asked him, "Hey, man, why don't you blow up the whole world over this Ukraine thing, huh, you sissy boy?" And so he responded back that, "Hey, you know, what's all the hurry? Why does everybody want to go to war all the time? Why, I prefer to wind down wars, as you can tell, and I don't want to send in troops, no way, and we made a deal, and we were able to avoid war with Syria. Why?" He's a regular peacenik. And those right-wingers who are encouraging, you know, a more belligerent foreign policy, why? I just frankly disagree with them. That's basically what he said. Invoked Ukraine and Syria and a few other examples here. So, okay, great. As far as answers go, I like the at least pretended immunity from right-wing criticism. But of course, he's just lying. He tripled the Afghan war for 2.5-3 years. It went from 30,000 troops to 100,000 troops over there. An entire surge that they knew couldn't work all along. Some peacetime. Thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of lives thrown away in doubling down a war that they knew they couldn't win. And if you go back to 2009, you know as well as I do. And all the they've been ratted out all over the place by now, too. Vali Nasser, who worked for Richard Holbrooke, wrote it up for Foreign Policy. A guy whose name I can't pronounce wrote a book called Little America and published excerpts from it in the Washington Post all about this. It's purely political. Barack Obama did mean to end the war in Iraq and not try too hard to stay. I'm not letting him off the hook. He did try to stay. But he didn't really, really push it. But he was afraid that those mean old Republicans would call him a pansy if he ended two wars. So he doubled down in Afghanistan, and immediately, from his third day in office, expanded the CIA drone war into Pakistan, and on that first strike, killed a bunch of women and children. exploded them to death in the worst nightmare anyone nearby had ever experienced in their entire lives. Oh, yeah, drone strike here, drone strike there. Yeah, that's a term. Sometimes you see it, you know, written on a page somewhere. But for the people who are bombed by hellfire missiles, and it's their women and their children who are killed, that's a big deal to them. And he's kept up the drone war in Pakistan almost this whole time. And of course, he's doubled down on Bush's horrific policy in Somalia, supporting the Ethiopian and, of course, entire African Union occupation there. Burundi and Uganda and Kenya all have troops there as well. And they've overseen the starvation of a quarter of a million people, and that's according to the U.S. government, an NGO sponsored by the U.S. government. And yes, it was a famine. It was a drought in the entire Horn of Africa. But they didn't have those kinds of numbers of deaths in Eritrea or in Ethiopia. And the reason why is because there was a war, an American war going on in Somalia. And of course, you already know, but I'm going to tell you, the people who died were the little bitty babies. They're the ones who died. More than half of them, according to the American-backed NGO FuseNet, it's called, were under 5 years old. That's Obama's foreign policy. Murdering little bitty babies because George Bush didn't like their government. And then he had a war in Libya. Does no one even care? He had a war in Libya that at the time was in the newspapers. This was, I mean, obviously they didn't highlight it. This wasn't the narrative, but it was there. If you read the Telegraph, if you were reading, you know, this, that, or the other, you know, source, if you're watching closely, if you were reading closely to the most qualified, you know, the writings of the most qualified journalists out of Libya, then you knew all along that this war was for the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Libyan remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq who had come home from the war. And Gaddafi was telling the truth when he said this is an Al-Qaeda plot, America working with Al-Qaeda. I don't know if it was exactly as tight as all of that as he said it, made him sound like a truther oversimplifying, but ultimately he was basically right. America was backing the veterans of the Iraq War who had fought the American occupation there in Libya in an undeclared war, which is hardly the worst part of it, but it is clearly illegal and impeachable. And it was for Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And, you know, there's a scandal today. Maybe this is the ultimate proof, the final, oh my God, of the Benghazi scandal. That the deputy national security advisor sent an email telling everyone, say it was the video. Remember, there was a stupid, you know, F movie about what a bad guy Mohammed was that came out and caused some protests in Cairo. Well, and then there was an attack. It was September 11th, 2012. There was an attack in Benghazi, and the American government talking points were this was another one of those riots, only this one got way out of hand. And it turned out it wasn't that. It was an attack by the Mujahideen that the Americans had been working with to overthrow Gaddafi and then had been working with to funnel guns to the Mujahideen in Syria. Another major achievement of Barack Obama's foreign policy, arming up the al-Nusra Front. Again, veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that was what blew up in their face on September 11th, 2012, and got the guy killed. And yet you don't ever hear the Republicans care about that, do they? Why don't the Republicans care that the entire regime change war against Gaddafi was fought for these Mujahideen who did what they did? In fact, you have to go to real kooks, like real hardcore ideologues, neocons who are so kooky that they're outside their own neocon narrative, who say, no way, this is going to power Islamists and we just can't have that. Absolutely not. Otherwise, the rest of the Republican Party consensus was do it. Their leaders, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who had been hardcore Al-Qaeda hawks back when, who became, I'm sorry, did I say Al-Qaeda? I meant Gaddafi hawks back when and became Gaddafi doves as late as 2009 and had tried to broker arms deals with him, had traveled to Libya and tried to sell him training for his special forces goon squads and tried to sell him armored personnel carriers for them and worse, and then ran to get out ahead of this and support the war. And remember, all their criticism of Obama was how weak he was on Libya. Hurry up and bomb Gaddafi out of power. No wonder all they want to talk about is that one attack against Ambassador Stevens in Benghazi that one day, and they don't want to say a word about the rest of the policy of Libya, how it spread the jihad and the war and destabilized Mali and got people killed there and provoked further French intervention there, how all these weapons got into the hands of a bunch of Al-Qaeda suicide bomber kooks in Syria, who now the Americans want, even the ones that they trust to arm, they want digital fingerprints and eyeball pics. And you can read about this at the anti-war blog, antiwar.com/blog, because they're afraid that these guys are going to blow back on us someday. The veterans of this jihad are going to blow back, just like the veterans of Ronald Reagan's jihad in Afghanistan in the 80s blew back against us all through the 1990s and on September 11th. Just like the war in Iraq has blown back on us, and all these guys have left, so many of them, not all of them, have left Iraq to go and spread the war throughout North Africa and into Syria. Well, all the guys fighting in North Africa and into Syria, well, they're all going to be veterans of those wars with all their new recruits, too. If you think you can drone strike all these guys away, you're crazy. It's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice on Fantasia. Mickey Mouse chopping up all the brooms, trying to kill him, but all he does is make more and more and more with every, you know, swing. Anyway, one sec. We'll be right back after these lies from Fox News. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on APSRadioNews.com, RonPaulRadio.com, AnomalyRadio.com, ScottHorton.org/listen. You can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Find all my archives at ScottHorton.org, my blog that I hardly ever write on. Anyway, yeah. So this is my show, and really, the most important thing I can do on this show is give you access to the great Gareth Porter. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back. I'm fine. In fact, I've just come from an event in D.C. where Ed Snowden was giving us a personal message. He got an award from the Nation Institute for truth-telling, for courage, excuse me, not for truth-telling, for courage, for obvious reasons. And it was quite inspiring to hear Snowden talk about his decision.
Oh, that's great. I saw a couple of things on Twitter about that was going on. I didn't realize that that's where you were. So
yeah, wow, that was the outstanding highlight of the event.
Yeah, you got it. Well, there are such things as American heroes. So, all right, now the headlines out of Syria, car bombings everywhere. From the Daily Mail, which I don't know how questionable this may or may not be, but sure does look legit, man. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant or whoever they are, these ISIS guys, these Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys, have apparently crucified a couple of guys to death in the city of Raqqa. And, of course, there are endless claims of new chemical weapons attacks, including, I guess, based on chlorine, which I guess I'll ask you about at the end of this interview. But all that, I mean, when these guys are being crucified and whatever, that hopefully ought to draw people's back attention, draw their attention back to this horrible crisis going on in Syria now and you know, the truth behind it all and what it all means and who's who and what the hell. And you've finally written about the August sarin attack, which is so important, and I'm so thankful that you have. It's at truthout.org. New data raise further doubt on official view of August 21st gas attack in Syria. Take us through it. Break it down.
Well, this is first of all, you're right that I finally got this out, and you're referring, of course, to the fact that there was an earlier period in last September when I was working on a piece. I worked on it for 3 weeks and finally decided not to go ahead with it because I was unable to put together what I thought was a coherent or understandable, reasonable picture of what happened. And since then, of course, a lot of controversy has swirled around the issue. A lot of positions have been taken on both sides of this. New information has come out. And now I took another look at this from a different perspective, which is not so much being able to tell people what happened, but rather to sort out what we know and what we don't know, and what begins to emerge in terms of the parameters of the problem. And so that is really what I tried to do in this rather long piece. And this is undoubtedly one of the more complicated, if not the most complicated pieces that I've ever tried to do. It has a lot of different moving parts, and it's, you know, it involves a whole series of issues. One, you know, whether the information we have now suggests that, in fact, the rockets that were discovered or that were fired into the environs of Damascus on August 21st had to come from the government-controlled areas, as was argued very strongly at the time in the weeks that followed, or not. Then a second issue that I get into in the piece is whether the opposition was really capable of mounting an attack with the amount of sarin that would be required for the attack. And that, of course, gets one into the whole question of how much sarin really was used or you know, might have been used in the attack. And then, you know, finally, I come down to another issue is supposedly smoking gun, which was the discovery of traces of hexamine or a form of hexamine. I won't even try to pronounce it. It's a very, very long, multi-syllable chemical compound that was found, you know, by the UN investigating team, which has been argued to be a smoking gun for the Syrian government having carried out the attack, because the Syrian government has included in its official declaration of chemical weapons to the OPCW the 80 tons of hexamine, and one of the people that I discuss in my piece has argued, that is Dan Cazetta, chemical weapons expert, has argued that this is a smoking gun, that it has to mean that it was the government that was the source of these traces. So then, you know, at the end of the piece, I come back to the whole question of how lethal was the attack, and look at new evidence, not so much new evidence, but evidence that really hasn't been examined, certainly by the news media, that has to do with the symptoms that were shown by the people that were interviewed by the UN investigating team. And what you find, what I found in looking at that data, was that it suddenly appears that the people who they were steered to by the opposition, that is the UN team was steered to by the opposition, weren't really exposed very seriously to sarin, certainly not as seriously as was made to appear at the time. So all these things are in the mix in this piece. It has at least four you know, bigger picture issues that I've covered, and that's kind of I mean, where I come down here at the end of it is that it now looks very much like it was a much less lethal attack than it was made out to be, certainly by the news media and by the U.S. government, and that it's much less clear who was responsible for this than it appeared to be the case at the time, that there was a strong case being made that there are various indicators that it must be the Syrian government. And finally, if you go back and look at the question, there are two questions. One, the question of capability, who was most capable or who was capable of carrying out the attack. But the other one is the problem of motivation. And I basically address that at the end of the piece and suggest that, it may still be the case that it would have been much easier for the Syrian government to carry out the attack in terms of capabilities, but it would appear that the primary the party that had the primary motive here for carrying out such an attack was indeed the opposition. So that is sort of a capsule summary of the piece that doesn't really go into any of the details much.
Right. Well, that's all right. We'll go through it. First of all, the last thing there about the motive, I remember Robert Baer, the former CIA officer, saying on TV back in 2011 or 12 maybe that, hey, if it comes down to it, he said, I know these Alawites, the ones in charge in Damascus. And if it comes down to it, they will use chemical weapons. But his real emphasis, I believe at the time, I think it's fair to characterize it, was if it comes down to it. And yet, they've never even been close this entire war long of losing power in Damascus. It has not come down to it at all, has it?
Well, yeah, let's take a look at that question very quickly, because that is indeed one of the issues surrounding motivation. It is perhaps the primary motivation that has been attributed to the government has been indeed that it was losing the war. It was afraid that it was very rapidly losing control, particularly in the Damascus area, and that this was a desperate effort to restore the momentum to the government forces' side. Indeed the argument has been made, but there's some serious questions about that. I mean, one of which is that, as I point out in my piece, the British intelligence paper, a two-page paper that was issued by British intelligence, actually more or less openly questions that notion that the government was desperate about, fearing that it was losing in the Damascus area. It, in fact, says, I don't have the quote in front of me, but it says essentially that there's no apparent reason why the government would take the risk of carrying out a chemical weapons attack under those circumstances, specifically circumstances that included having the UN team ensconced right there in Damascus within a couple of kilometers or 2 to 3 kilometers at very most of the scene of the chemical attack. So one of the major intelligence agencies that's involved in this issue really did not buy that idea that there was that was a motive for the government to carry out the attack.
All right, we'll have to hold it right here and go out to this break. We're talking with Gareth Porter. Here he is at Truth Out, where he wins awards for his journalism. New data raised further doubt on official view of August 21 gas attack in Syria, the one that almost led to an American air campaign, at least, the end of last summer. Back right after this with Gareth Porter.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is the website. I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter. Mostly he's at Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, but he also writes for truthout.org, won the Gellhorn Award for his work on Petraeus and McChrystal's surge in Afghanistan there at Truthout. This piece is called New Data Raise Further Doubt on Official View of August 21st, gas attack in Syria. You know that big there was me spacing out when I was supposed to say he's the author of the most important book of this year and last year and the one before that and probably next year too, and that is Manufactured Crisis, the truth about the Iran nuclear scare, which debunks every bit of what you ever heard about the threat of Iran's nuclear program. And it's good, man, real good, and it should win whatever all prizes they give away for journalistic books like this. It's absolutely incredible and irrefutable. Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. Okay, now, so back to
Thanks
the article
the
here. It's New Data Raise Further Doubt on the Official View of the August 21st Gas Attack in Syria. And so he sort of gave us the overview here. We talked about the motive and how there was no motive. But you know what? Let me go ahead and ask you this now, even though this isn't in your article, I don't think, unless I did kind of read it fast. I might have missed it. What about the gas attacks from right around a year ago? There's even a speech that I gave right a year ago where I brought up how the Israelis were saying, aha, a chemical attack, and it was Assad who did it, and how it was Kerry himself who told the Israelis to pipe down about it, and that there was no conclusive evidence that that was the case, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
I thought so, but I interpreted it then, it's in the speech, that I interpreted it, Kerry's signal to them as to wait. It's not time to exploit this particular narrative yet. That was the way that played out a year ago. So what was going on there, do you think? That was a rebel attack?
I'm glad you've raised the issue, because it is very important to understand that whole series of alleged chemical weapons attacks that started. I mean, the first one that I remember specifically, because I was actually going to write about this, but I didn't have the space to do it in this piece, was December of 2012 in Homs, and then there was another series of, I believe, roughly seven. I could be off by one or two alleged attacks, and of course, you know, it varies depending on who's listing them. I mean, there's some organizations that listed even far more than that, but the point that I would make is that in most of those cases, it seems pretty clear that it was not a chemical weapon. It was not a sarin attack at all. The evidence that I saw was I looked at the details that were available in all but one of those attacks indicated that it was most likely, almost certainly, it was a combination of a smoke grenade of some sort mixed perhaps with CS gas. And that combination could easily cause the kind of respiratory symptoms that were experienced by many of the people who were the victims that were shown in videos in these attacks. Now, there was one exception, and that was the attack on Khan al-Assal in March of 2013, and that was the one that, of course, the Syrian government charged was a rebel attack and wanted the UN to go investigate it. And indeed,
that's what they were doing there, as you indicated before the break.
That's what they were doing in Damascus. But of course, the UN wanted to be able to visit other sites where other alleged attacks had taken place.
Which, by the way, Gareth, I know a couple of Branch Davidians who could refute that CS is not a chemical weapon. That's some pretty harsh stuff. And when you burn it, it turns into hydrogen cyanide, which is how they kill people in the gas chamber. So,
well, that's
it's
fair enough.
Pretty nasty
stuff,
but it's not sarin.
I agree that that's a very dangerous weapon, and that it can actually cause people to die.
And I think it's banned by the Geneva Conventions for use in international warfare anyway.
I'm not aware that CS gas is banned in international warfare. You may be right. I don't recall that that's the case, but I cede to you if you've checked on that.
Well, I think that I couldn't prove it to you right now, but yeah. I bet I could if I looked. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But in any case, this was clearly not a sarin attack, as was claimed both by the opposition groups as well as by ultimately the United States government and its allies, who used that as part of the argument that it was certain that the August 21st attack was carried out by the Syrian government. So it is very, very relevant, and I do in fact believe that evidence does not really hold up.
All right. So now let's get to the location data. If we can break this down and get through your article here. Originally, the story was that these chemical rockets had come from, 9 kilometers away or 6 kilometers away, was it? And that it had to have been this military base, agreed a couple of different investigations right from the beginning, correct?
That's correct. I mean, the military base was north, of course, of the of Mohammedia, which was one of the neighborhoods that was hit. And if I remember my map in my head correctly, northwest of the other neighborhood that was the primary one hit. So this was indeed supposed to be the place that was pinpointed by the New York Times, and originally it was considered by the two. Researchers who were quoted very widely in the press, Ted Postol and Richard Lloyd, they also agreed that was the case. So now suddenly that turns out not to be correct, because when Lloyd and Postol reviewed the whole question of the mechanism, that the rocket that was used to carry out the attack in all but one of those neighborhoods, that is Mohammedia, they found that in fact it would not go more than about 2 kilometers or about 1.2 miles. And so that whole theory about the military base north of there that was, I think, 9.6 kilometers away was suddenly taken off the map of the political map of this issue, and that has represented a fundamental shift in the whole debate. And then you get the next round was our friend Brown Moses or Elliot Higgins coming out with a new argument that yes, okay, it may have been a much shorter trajectory, a much shorter range, but it could have come from a government controlled area, maybe 2.5 kilometers away, and that then became the primary argument for the Syrian government responsibility.
Conceivably, anyway. Wait a minute. Let's win friends and influence people here. You could concede that could be possible. It wasn't launched from there. It was launched from here. Well, still, it's still government territory. So what about that?
Well, what about that is that. It turns out that what Elliot Higgins claims was government-controlled territory was really not government-controlled territory. In fact, it was an area the point that he is now pinpointing, which was east of what is called the Jobar-Kabun Industrial zone is it's an area where a bunch of highways come together, and apparently, according to an expert who has contested the Elliot Higgins argument, Charles Wood, a forensic expert who has been watching videos specifically about that specific area, he says that in fact the government troops were under fire; they were being attacked. Even on August 21st, that there was, you know, that they were fighting off an attack by the rebels. That was a very highly contested area, and that this is based on specifically on visual evidence that he has seen. So that argument appears to be at best extremely contested and not at all strongly documented at this point.
All right, now here's the problem: we have a conflict between how thorough your work is here and the time on the clock, and your busy schedule. Can I keep you another segment, or do I need to let you go?
Well, normally I would say yes, but I do in fact need to leave for an appointment in D.C., which is actually an hour earlier than I thought it was when I first spoke with you. So
okay, no problem.
Maybe we can try another day this week.
Yeah, let's follow up, because there's still some more questions I'd like to give you a chance to answer and give people more of a chance to find this work.
We've only touched the surface, obviously.
Right. Okay. Well, that's all right. That's how radio works. Thanks very much for your time, Gareth, as always. Good talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me again. Thanks, Scott.
All right, everybody. So that's the great Gareth Porter. He writes at ipsnews.net and at truthout.org. And this one is at Truthout. It's called "New Data Raises Further Doubt on Official View of August 21 Gas Attack in Syria." Very important work there at truthout.org by the author of the book Manufactured Crisis: The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Weapons Threat. Now here's some Fox lies, and no, here's a couple commercials. Good, the Fox is over. We'll be right back in a sec.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Well, so there was a lot there we didn't get to talk about, including the most recent attacks, which are also being blamed on the government. Apparently, barrel bombs full of chemical weapons dropped from helicopters, that's the accusation. Sure would like to hear what Gareth thinks of that. Anyway, we'll get him back on the show tomorrow, the next day or something. I think I'm right that CS gas is banned by Geneva for use in international war. Not so much against your own citizens. Don't worry, Bill Clinton. Not like laws apply to Bill Clinton or ever have. But anyway, you know. All right. Well, so hell. Go look at this article, man. It's good. As though you guys needed any further debunking of the story. But it just goes to show, man. I don't know what all it goes to show. You know what goes to show me? Wow, I think maybe my old joke proved correct, that George Bush's foreign policy was actually just meant to discredit interventionism from now on. This was actually, it goes along with how I used to joke with the people in my cab back during the election of 2000. As I would say, well, you know, Bush is a commie and Al Gore is a fascist. They're both completely horrible. And so, you know, but if you had to hold a gun to my head, I would have to pick Bush only because he's such a pathetic, cruel, spiteful, childish, ignorant little buffoon. Did I say little twice? He's just pathetic. And he's such a boob that he'll never be able to get away with the kind of crimes that Al Gore could competently achieve. You know? That was my idea. And I guess, boy, that September 11th attack, that sure gave him an approval rating that lasted forever, man. It just took forever to bring it down. After the greatest failure of any American leader ever. Isn't that funny? Rally around the flag, right? So, but anyway, ultimately it proved true. He was so bad at being an imperialist that he blew it up. He took the sports car out and he wrecked it. Just like the childish frat boy buffoon that he is. The shadow of his Nazi-loving grandpa. And he really has discredited interventionism to such a great degree. You know, I don't know, you know, how else to explain it. For them to try to lie us into war and to have it not work. That's what happened last September. The American people just said no. And the politicians said, man, and they backed down. And the thing is, it's not that it was any less of a good excuse for any of the other wars that they've ever lied us into. I mean, they had all the weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda for Iraq. They pretended as though the Taliban refused to negotiate the surrender of Osama bin Laden, which was, of course, completely untrue. And they lied about how they baited Saddam Hussein. Well, they lied in Kosovo when they basically bombed over a so-called peace offer that they couldn't possibly expect to be accepted. It wasn't a peace offer at all. It was an ultimatum that Milosevic must accept NATO occupation of all of Serbia up to and including his bedroom and his office. And, of course, it was just an excuse to bomb there and break Kosovo off from Serbia, which is a sin when Russians do it and is virtue when Americans do it, you understand. And then there was the whole bombing campaign of the 90s against Iraq, like I talked about, based on the lie that they were somehow the price was worth it because they were trying to convince the Iraqi people that it's going to keep being like this unless you get rid of this guy for us. And yet they knew that that wasn't going to work, and that wasn't really their plan. They just wanted to keep Iraq as weak as they could until they could get around to regime change. Simple as that. And then, of course, they baited Saddam into invading Kuwait in the first place by encouraging the Kuwaitis and the Saudis to stick it to him and to not let him make enough money to pay them back the money he borrowed from them to fight a war on their behalf against Iran and for Ronald Reagan as well in the 1980s. And, you know, they lied us into Grenada where they pretended that there was a real threat to those students there. There was no threat to the students. They just wanted to do a thing after being humiliated in Lebanon was all. And, man, I'm sure I'm probably leaving some out. Of course, Vietnam is the worst with the Gulf of Tonkin lie that there was this attack on the battleship Maddox, which was completely false, and they knew it, of course, at the time. It was just the amateur sonar man on duty, which was the explanation for them successfully dodging 14 torpedoes all damn day long. Man, you're good at steering this boat, Captain! No, there are no torpedoes. And then, of course, they lied us into Korea by ignoring all of the provocations that the South Koreans were committing against the North to provoke them into coming across the border. They lied us into World War II with all of Roosevelt's attempts to provoke a war on the high seas with the Germans. And then when that failed, his 8-point plan to provoke Japan into attacking America first at Pearl Harbor, where he deliberately turned a blind eye and allowed 3,500 people to be killed in order so he could have his war in Europe, mostly. And then, of course, they lied us into World War I with the ridiculous Zimmerman telegram. And there are 100 interventions in Latin America here that I could never, you know, mention. You'll just have to go read William Bloom or something. But the big wars, anyway, World War I, the Zimmerman telegram, a promise to the Germans that they were going to help Mexico reinvade the American Southwest and take it back. Utah and Nevada and Colorado and California, New Mexico and Arizona. Yeah, right. I don't know if that include Colorado or not. Anyway, yeah, right. That is the most ridiculous pretext for war. You've got to be kidding me. That was Wilson's pretext for getting America into World War One. And then, of course, there's the battleship Maine, where they pretended that was a Spanish attack when it was nothing but a fire on the boat that spread to the magazine and exploded. And then before that, there was the provocation at Fort Sumter. You have to admit, no matter what your position, that for the feds to refuse to close that tax collection fort, or whatever I think it was, in South Carolina's bay, there was a provocation. And culminated, of course, came out with, eventually, did provoke the South into firing. No one was hurt, but anyway, they fired on it. So that was the dawn of the American Civil War. Another dishonest kind of a pretext. Rigged up, making the crisis worse than it had to be, kind of a thing. And then, of course, the threat to invade through all the border states and provoking them into seceding and making the war, you know, that much worse for the army, size of the army on the other side, etc., etc., etc. And then before that, of course, the war in Mexico was based on a provocation across the San Jacinto River, which was deemed to be the southern border of Texas by the Mexicans. But the Texicans said, hell no, man, we are going all the way to the Rio Grande. And so they attacked Mexican troops between the San Jacinto and the Rio Grande, and then that became the excuse. Their reaction became the excuse for waging war against Mexico and seizing 2/3 of that. Of course, there's all the Indian wars and all the massacres are going unmentioned here. The lie there being God said, go ahead and kill them all because this land belongs to you and me and not them. So good, manifest destiny and all that. Oh, and by the way, you know, they started it. So, yeah, Spotty Lincoln, it was Abraham Lincoln that called out Polk for the provocation in Mexico. And then, of course, the War of 1812 was just an attempt by the Southern Democrats to steal Canada, which seemed like would have helped the Northerners politically, but I don't know. But the Democrats wanted to steal Canada, so they exploited the crisis of impressment on the high seas. But really, it was about aggressive war, and it was a complete failure and a catastrophe. And it was, you know, Jefferson helped set up the crisis and then supported Madison in getting into the war. You know, the North almost seceded from the Union over the War of 1812 through 14. They call it Mr. Madison's War. The fact that it was even in dispute, whether it was really necessary or not, right there just goes to prove that the just storybook where, oh, the evil British tried to take back the American Revolution and all that. It just couldn't possibly be right. Mostly the War of 1812-14 is just a black hole in our education, and so they fill it up with, yeah, they started it, we're good guys, and they burnt the White House, those bastards. I don't know what you think of the American Revolution. I'm for independence, but maybe it didn't have to be waged the way that they said when you take into account how they lied us into every war ever. And that's every major war there. And that's just off the top of my head. I'm sure I missed some. Sorry for all the dead. I didn't mention all the repeated invasions of Mexico and Bolivia and all the coup d'etats and all the murders and all the spying and all the treacherous alliances and all of that stuff. But where are we now? George Bush finally just lied us into war. Too big and too dumb and too stupid and with too brutal of consequences, too obvious of consequences for people. It's sort of like Woodrow Wilson again, where never even mind Vietnam syndrome. We got World War One syndrome now. We don't want anything to do with your empire anymore. And nor should we. And nor is that cowering in isolationism. That's doing the right thing. That's stopping doing the wrong thing. Empire is evil and it's murder-suicide, and so cool it. Save money. Stop killing people. How's that? That's my conservative argument for peace right there. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace.
It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. Anybody wants to call in the show today, we still got one segment left here. The number is 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836. The question of the day is, I guess if I could figure out a way to phrase it right, I wonder to what degree you think that people in your environment, you know, the people around you, whatever community in America you might happen to be in, whether basically this passes for peacetime right now. It's not the era of perpetual war. It's all that's over. All that ended with the end of the Iraq war back in, like, really 10, right? 09, 010 was when they quit the major American battles there. Or, you know, do you think people are even really conscious of the fact that our government's been killing people all the time? Of course, they lied us into Libya. The giant threat of a giant massacre that was going to happen. Obama gave a speech and literally assured the American people that Muammar Gaddafi was going to send in his forces and they were going to kill everyone in Benghazi. Men, women, and children all faced ultimate death penalty offense for daring to resist Gaddafi's wrath, blah, blah. And that was the massacre that he had to preempt. You know, Bill Clinton pretended that 100,000 Kosovar Albanians had been killed. And of course, they hadn't. There were only a few thousand deaths, and those were all at least fighting age males, if not fighting males. It was certainly nothing like hundreds of thousands. He said 100,000 men, women, and children massacred, Bill Clinton claimed. I don't know how anyone believed that at the time. In the space of how long this was supposed to have occurred. And under what conditions? Give us a break. But at least he had the decency to pretend that those massacres actually happened, right? Where Obama just said, there's going to be a massacre of all civilians in eastern Libya. And so that's why we have to do a regime change in Tripoli. What a hoax. That's as bad as any of them. So he's as guilty from the empires, from their court historians' point of view in the future. He'll be as guilty as George W. Bush for discrediting American intervention for all time. George Bush fights a war in Iraq that benefits our strategic adversary, Iran, to such a great degree, it's almost unimaginable. Certainly, it's unimaginable by anyone in 2003, and that would even include the Ayatollah and the Supreme Islamic Council and anyone else on the eve of that regime change. They could have never imagined. But at the same time, he turned all of the Sunni provinces of Iraq into lawless jihadistan for now 11 years in a row. And spread that jihad all over hither and yon. Really? I mean, in Syria, they have direct access to the sea, don't they? And anyway, and there will be, of course, a whole new generation of Hezbollah fighters who will be battle-hardened fighters from all of their time backing Assad in the war that America has helped escalate on one side and that Iran is then obliged to escalate on the other and the rest. These guys have a legacy of blood and idiocy. And nothing that they have done has accomplished anything that could possibly be considered in the national interests of the United States of America. Only of their selected cronies at the expense of the rest of us. Simple as that. And yeah, that includes Israel. They're just another special interest group in Washington, D.C., only they're better at it than most. Witness John Kerry's recent groveling over words. Again with the words. Obama, every day, blows up little children to death. You know, their body parts burning, flying in all directions. In the most horrible nightmare that you could never imagine that happening in your life. Holy crap. That happening in your neighborhood kind of a thing. He does that every day. And the worst word, the worst slur he ever uses is he calls people terrorist, which is pretty bad. You deny them their rights right off the bat. Once you call them that, you can kill them. Oh, but at least he's not racist. At least he doesn't say anything politically correct that would hurt someone's feelings as he murders people. And he's still held up. Oh, you gotta respect that office. He's still held up as the paragon of virtue and especially as the leader of minorities in America. What you can accomplish if you only work hard, you can blow up little children to death every day just like the President of the United States, and it's perfectly fine. Just don't anybody call anybody any names. Apartheid? Why? That's a word that people attach meaning to. And it's dangerously apt. And so, oh, boo-hoo. Right? He might as well have called, I don't know, every Jew in the world the K-word. Right? The ultimate insult. But all he said was, Israel has a policy that is self-destructive from the point of view of their interests. Yeah, the American imperialists know a policy like that when they see one. And John Kerry said, the problem with an apartheid situation is it's not sustainable for a long period of time. The Israeli Jews rule too many people outside of their own exclusive group, which they make quite exclusive. And so, the numbers are against them, as they always say. The Palestinians keep making more babies. Sooner or later, it won't just be a complete, total system of second-class citizenship for Israeli Arabs, and third and fourth and fifth and whatever you call it, class citizenship, no class citizenship whatsoever, for the people of the West Bank, it will be a majority oppressed by the minority in that exact same situation. And then that's really bad politics when the West dresses up their entire empire as some kind of democracy-spreading project. And Israel's supposed to be our greatest democratic ally in the Middle East. Well, so what happens if they're not democratic anymore? And so Kerry's his talk, what his statement there at this recorded trilateral commission meeting, and it could have been deliberately leaked. I don't think so. It was deliberately leaked by whoever recorded it, I don't know, to Josh Rogan at the Daily Beast. And all he was saying was, oh, man, and Ali Abunima has an article, I think that's how you say it, something like that, has an article at antiwar.com, running at antiwar.com today, saying this as well, quite correctly, that Kerry doesn't care at all about the Palestinians. He's not talking about what's justice for them at all. All he's saying is, geez, guys, if we could figure out a way to save Israel from themselves, the Israeli government, the Israeli country from the Israeli government, that's probably a better way to say it. We could save the Israeli country, the Israeli nation, from the Israeli government's leadership. What we would do is we would have them all get it through their thick skull that they got to sort of kind of more or less give up the West Bank. They've got to not, you know, grant the right of return or any of those things, not give justice to the Palestinians, but make, in a sense, make their occupation more legitimate by making a semi-credible two-state, second-state Palestinian state on the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. If it's sort of, kind of, a little bit a Palestinian state, then it's easier to continue the occupation under maybe somewhat reduced terms, but still, basically just as a matter of spin. They can continue accomplishing their same oppression. That's the point of view of Ali Abunima, who's one of the leaders of the one-state solution argument from the Palestinian point of view there. And I think he's quite correct in his assessment of what John Kerry is about, for sure. And I don't think, come on, get real. Could there ever really be such a thing as a Palestinian state, a real independent state? I mean, if you ever hear the Israelis talk about what a Palestinian state would look like, it ain't a state. It ain't anything like independence whatsoever. But then again, I have trouble imagining a one-state solution that doesn't include some horrific civil war, too. So, you know, I don't know if there is a... You know, Israelis could just come to a consensus and start doing the right thing. But anyway, that'll be a fantasy for another show. All right. Oh, a cop got fired because a lot of people called and complained about what he did to a dog. But it worked, the complaint, so take that under advisement.